The cloud yearns for automation. It's got all those shiny APIs just sitting, waiting to be called by your intricate infrastructure as code running in a CI/CD pipeline. But how do you pick the right tool for the job? Do you dive into the deep arcana of ARM templates, or instead stick to the sleek sophistication of Terraform? Do you run your CI/CD pipeline through open source Jenkins, or stay the course with the recently renamed Azure DevOps? Which is going to support your needs for day one and keep you running on day two? Welcome to Day 2 Cloud, a frank discussion of what happens when cloud stops being polite and starts getting real. This is episode 9, and I am your host, Ned Bellavance, Ned1313 on the Twitters. Joining me today is a man with a passion for PowerShell, a desire for better DSC, and an automation engineer working in Switzerland, Mr. Ryan Bartram. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
Thank you very much, Ned. That was a cool intro. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, I know. So I looked at your website a little bit, and you definitely seem to be all about the PowerShell and desired state configuration, if anybody doesn't know what DSC stands for. How did you get into PowerShell and automation and DSC?
I think it's one of those things where people consider myself as a bit lazy. I don't want to do too much work. And I think one of the first things I got given to do was like an exchange migration of like 18,000 mailboxes. And I thought, don't really want to click that thing together. So I started working my way through the Exchange PowerShell, which, no offense to the Exchange PowerShell team, that's probably one of the worst implementations of PowerShell I've ever seen.
It's not great.
Yeah. Second probably only to like the old VMware PowerCLI that's written with those old
the
module types.
Right?
Not even module, the snap-ins, PS snap-ins.
God.
Oh my days.
Yeah, I feel that.
Yeah. There are obviously other hypervisors and other mail providers, but those two stand out to me as being banes of my automation when I was getting started.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's how I definitely got started. Just being a lazy person.
I hear that. Yeah, that's PowerShell. My first introduction was Exchange as well. It's 2007, and they were really like the first major product to jump on board with it. So it doesn't surprise me that like all the conventions and stuff that we take for granted in PowerShell today, none of that really existed in 2007. So they were kind of winging it, for lack of a better term. I understand that the commandlets have gotten a little better in the last, 10 years, 12 years. Good Lord. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So jumping into our conversation a little bit, so I understand that you use a lot of automation and, design patterns for rolling out infrastructure and applications. So can you tell me a little bit about sort of that situation and what you're doing today?
Yeah, so this I guess it sort of depends on what you're sort of talking about. So I guess the topic of today's sort of twofold. I guess we've got our little DSC world we talk about, and I think most people sort of put that in a little box by itself. It's like, oh my gosh, what is DSC? That seems so complicated. But if we sort of come back to sort of the more traditional process-based automation, we here at the company I work for, we have this sort of pattern solution model where we create runbooks that are just functions, and we call those patterns, and we join those together in Azure Automation, or in the old days with SMA, into solutions. So there would be like one solution-based runbook that calls out to a ton of pattern runbooks, and then you end up with a reusable intelligent pattern, a solution that can do anything from user provisioning to disk management when an alert goes off, or whatever crazy things you want to do in your onboarding processes.
Okay, that's interesting. So what would be some examples? You gave a few, but what would be some examples of patterns that you've developed to do these deployments?
So a pattern might be initially just getting a user. So when you're talking about old school Active Directory, you could just use a get AD user command, but it may not retrieve all the information that you want it to retrieve. You might want to retrieve information from various different locations. Maybe you've got an interface into your HR system, or an interface into some other identity management for whatever it could be, password management, etc. So you may create one pattern which just retrieves all of your get user information, so you can then determine whether the right property is set, for example. Another pattern might be something as simple as just testing is a server available. You could just by doing it might just mask the testnet connection command. But if you're trying to, as your automation person, you're always trying to make someone mm-hmm. else's life easier. So if I want to, if someone's sitting there trying to write a solution, they don't want to have to necessarily understand the nuances of the testnet connection command. They may just want to say test server available, and they can just give the server name, and then I can run commands in the background to determine whether that machine responds on the network. If it doesn't respond on the network, maybe I can also go and check, is it already in Active Directory, etc., and then return a true or false. So those are different types of patterns that you could use.
Okay. And so then you're taking those patterns, almost like modules, and snapping them together to create a whole solution?
Exactly, yeah. So this is, like I say, it's more of the traditional type model that we used to implement for SMA and Azure Automation. You just click these little sort of bricks together, if you want to call them, and then they make this big whatever you're trying to build, a big car or a big house or whatever you're trying to build out of these bricks.
Right, and I imagine that you're constantly adding new bricks.
Yeah, that's one of the big things about. One of the big things that should be about automation is reusability. So I can always just keep adding functionality, week by week by week. And then the solutions become more and more complex. So on day one, I might just have a solution which creates a user and it just goes ahead and creates a user in Azure Active Directory. Mm-hmm. And then on day two, when I deploy the next user, it might not just create the user. It might also go and reset the password and send it to them via their mobile device. And it's this iterative approach that we get when we sort of live in this agile mode where we just continually iterate over our versions and small improvements over time. So, yeah.
Okay. And so a follow-up question to that is, when do you decide that, this functionality shouldn't be in like the solution master script? This should be its own new pattern that snaps into a solution. Like, what is there a critical mass or some type of task you're like, ooh, that should be kind of its own thing?
I think the general rule, I don't know if people are just generally familiar with the concept of writing a function, your runbooks and patterns, you're trying to break them down into like a function. So you want to keep them to a single action as small as you can possibly get them. So like I say, it may be simply just getting something or it's testing something. If you notice that you're doing more than one particular action, for example, you could be testing and getting in the same function, or you're getting and setting in the same function. Then you start thinking to yourself, okay, those things could be split out because they do two separate things, and they can be, we're heading off down a bit of another track here, but testing is going to be different in that regard. And people, when they're using it, they might not want to do the two things you've built into that function. They might only want to get, they don't want to get and set. So I guess as well, there are some sort of guidelines that people say in terms of like, you want to keep it to like less than 100 lines and stuff like that. But that's, you're getting sort of really down the best practices guidelines, right. Complexity, not having tons of if statements and switch statements. But I think just to keep it simple, you want to try and keep it to a single action.
Okay. Yeah, that would be sort of, I guess you call it maybe the atomic unit of an action. And I guess you also want to keep it pretty simple just so you can snap it out with a different building block if you want to replace that functionality with something else.
Exactly, yeah. So I sort of went a long way around it. I think you sort of nicely encapsulated it there with that atomic note there. So, but you basically want to sort of keep them as sort of black boxes, if you want to think of them as that way. They have defined inputs, they have defined outputs, and whatever happens inside there doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. But you want to be as easily swap them out if necessary. So if you sort of come back to our user provisioning example I just had before, maybe day one you're dealing with a customer that's working with on-premise Active Directory. And then you want to switch to another customer that's using Azure Active Directory, or that customer migrates. You don't want to have to rewrite your entire solution. You can just take your brick, which you did your get Active Directory user, and swap it out for your get Azure AD user brick, as it were.
Sure.
So, yeah, keeping them sort of isolated is a good practice as well for function development.
Right. I can imagine a function that could take different arguments, like one set of arguments for Active Directory and a different set of arguments for Azure AD, and calling a different function depending on which arguments you give it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, in terms of how you're using all this automation, so we've talked a lot about the automation, but not so much the platform you're using for running it all. But it sounds like you're primarily using Azure Automation. What sort of drove that decision to use Azure Automation as opposed to some other task scheduling and job running platform?
Well, I guess that's the only supported Microsoft solution right now that's based in the cloud.
Okay.
If you sort of cast your minds back to the way it was on premise, you may have worked with things like Orchestrator, System Center Orchestrator. Mm-hmm. Like the beast of a thing, and then then we got given SMA, which is part of like Azure Pack.
Okay.
So then you could work with that, and that's very similar in its design to Azure Automation. I think they're very closely related in terms of their actual code. And then the next iteration was Azure Automation. So we've just sort of followed that trail of thought. But sort of in the last 12 months, I would say I got very excited when Azure Functions was released, and then Azure the version one, and then we could use PowerShell as an experimental option. You have to go in and change like 100 drop downs until you can actually see the PowerShell version.
Yeah.
But you can create PowerShell functions, and I actually use those.
Okay,
on a completely separate nerd note, I had PowerShell functions that controlled my website for my wedding. So,
good for
so
you.
If people would fill out the contact form, it would trigger a PowerShell function, which would log all of the invitees into an Azure storage table. But then I guess there are other, we don't want to be limiting ourselves. So you can, one supported platform provider out there is Amazon. You can use AWS's Lambda.
Mm-hmm.
Platform to write supported PowerShell core functions.
Oh, so I didn't realize Lambda supported PowerShell core now. That I guess that's pretty recent.
Oh, I think that was the end of last year.
Okay.
It's GA. It's not even experimental.
Oh, wow.
Or preview or whatever other label you want to put on it. It's PowerShell core on their Lambda platform. Go for it.
Very cool. Okay. And so the way that you're running it today, so you've got these Azure Automation, and for those that aren't familiar with Azure Automation, sort of, I guess the main component is runbooks.
Yeah.
And then runbooks can hook into other things in Azure or call other runbooks themselves. Is that sort of the model there?
Yeah. So they had, when it was originally set out, they used this weird thing called PowerShell workflows.
Mm-hmm.
I think for the most part that's dead. I think that's dead now. I don't think many people use that. So now that they just use Windows PowerShell.
Okay.
I don't want to put 100% label on it, but I think for the most part it's everywhere Windows 5.1.
Okay.
depending on which node you get on, you sometimes get like a weird environment that's not quite up to date. But it's Windows PowerShell 5.1. So you can write whatever code you want in there, and you can call out to your normal PowerShell modules. They have what they call like an internal module gallery, where you can install modules from the PowerShell gallery, or you can upload your own modules, and then they're always available when you execute. So if you've got your own development and you write some special module to do something, you can access that as well within Azure Automation.
Okay. And so what's invoking these runbooks that you have? Is it like a scheduled task, or are you using some other mechanism for calling the runbooks?
So that's a bit of like a trigger topic for some people. So I think when I try to push the more modern way. So there's sort of two ways you can think about automation. You can have a reactive type scenario where some event is triggered. Perhaps a user starts the runbook. That's a very basic event. You could have a system alert something. So maybe a disk is full up or something, and that triggers an alert. Or you've got these more traditional scenarios where you say, okay, I'm going to run this every 30 minutes.
Okay.
So you can create cron jobs in Azure Automation. It's 100% fine.
Oh. Okay.
And your runbook will sit there and run every hour or every day or whatever. And perhaps you can use that for like a cleanup task. So you say, okay, I'm going to clean out my table storage, every day so that I don't get charged for that space I'm using. But you're paying for every hour that you're running the runbook, and perhaps it doesn't clean everything out every hour. So I try and encourage my customers to change their way of thinking and say, okay, I don't just want to run this every day just because, you know, that's what I used to do before with Windows Task Scheduler, but I want to react to a particular scenario. Either, yeah, my disk is full, so I'm going to do this, or a new user is created in my HR system, therefore I want to create a new user in Azure AD. You know, these sort of event-driven triggers are sort of the way forward, and you see that in Azure as well. They've got the Azure Event Hub where you can drive events through there. And yeah, I think that's you see that as well. That's one of the key things of Azure Function as well, that it has all these different triggers into different systems.
Right. So something like, was it Azure Monitor is their monitoring tool, because they get really creative with naming. And I appreciate that, actually, because AWS's naming scheme is like, if you didn't know what Lambda was, you would have no chance of figuring it out. But Azure Functions are just Azure Functions. And if you want to know what the backup solution in Azure, it's called Azure Backup. Like, less guessing there. But in terms of, like, you have your Azure Monitor that could be monitoring things, and that can then fire off events that would trigger something in your runbooks, right? Is that sort of the workflow?
Yeah.
Okay. Very cool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you can have as well. So I sort of come back to more traditional examples like storage and stuff, but you can have things, for example, when a new resource is created in Azure, go and tag it with a particular tag. Not because, I mean, you could go down the other route and have it proactive with an Azure Blueprint or something that tags it automatically. But say, for example, you have a test lab where people just have free roam to create whatever they want. You can have runbooks which are automatically triggered by those tasks in Azure, and then react to those. Like I say, either you can go and tag that item, you can go and shut it down as soon as somebody starts that machine up. Which is, I know that, but, you know, I don't want you charging too much time. As soon as that machine's on 20 minutes, I'm going to shut it down or whatever. So you can react to all sorts of events in Azure.
Right, you're not necessarily limited to Azure, right? Anything could fire an event to cause that workbook to run. So if you're using, you know, some third party identity management thing like Okta, as long as that can send a webhook, then you could have a runbook get triggered by that.
Yeah. So I sort of avoided the technical term there, but yeah, you can basically, you're just triggering a webhook whenever you do that. So I've got customers that use like Kibana for their monitoring on premise, and then they trigger Azure runbooks through the webhook.
Okay.
That way.
The other thing that we didn't get a chance to talk about yet, but I mentioned it at the top, was desired state configuration. So sort of what are you using that for today, and what's the plan for using DSC? Because I'm familiar with it, but I haven't seen a whole bunch of people actually using it in practice.
Yeah, I think that's one of the really, really sad things about DSC. I think I try to push it everywhere I go. I've had massive projects. I'm talking like massive data center deployments, like hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of servers being deployed, you know, like deploying a whole rack and then making sure that whole rack is deployed with storage spaces direct, and then building your Azure Active Directory on top, and sort of the old school environment there in that case with all DSC. And then I've got it as well just running for very, very small things. Like the one topic we didn't talk about with the Azure automation is by default it runs in the cloud. So you always, it just spins up a little container and you're running in Azure and everything's happy. But, you know, unfortunately, not all our customers live in the cloud yet. It's one of the unfortunate things. So we need to access their on-premise infrastructure. So there's something called the hybrid worker.
Okay.
And what that allows you to do is you can run your Azure automation runbooks on-premise.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's just quite a cool thing. It's just like a little agent that you install. It's actually the OMS agent, which is, you know, probably renamed now 100 times. Now we've got now Azure Monitoring, so it's like the Azure Monitoring agent. Yeah. But basically, you install the OMS agent on a machine, and it gets added into your OMS workspace, and then it basically then gets made available in your Azure Automation account. You can just trigger your runbooks there.
Okay.
But that whole process is a bit convoluted, and I didn't want to have manually run that. And I also didn't want to create a script that somebody would have to go and run on that machine manually. You know, I've half automated the job, but still someone has to go there and run it. And if I have any updates, someone has to go and run it again. So in that case, I created a DSC configuration for that. So there's a DSC configuration which is responsible for deploying the OMS agent. It goes and deploys any modules that I think are necessary for sort of like the default setup of that hybrid worker. And then if I want to upgrade all my hybrid workers in that environment, I just have to go into my pool server, which it exists also in Azure Automation, and update the configuration, and the machines automatically update themselves. So,
okay. I mean, that sounds like a really good use case for it. And I've played around with DSC a little bit with the pull server and Azure Automation. I understand there's also, you can run pull server locally, but there's a project to keep that afloat, because I guess Microsoft isn't really actively developing that anymore.
Yeah. So I think a lot of people would probably be sitting there thinking, oh my gosh, so they're talking about so many different terms, like the pool server and just DSC generally, like what is that thing? So, I mean, there are a ton of materials you guys can go and look online to go and find it out. But just sort of, just to your point there about the on-premise pool server, it's a built-in feature of Windows Server. So you can just enable it by just installing the Windows feature. And then it's just a website that you have to create. Okay. But because we're DSC people, we don't want to do that by hand. So there's actually a DSC resource which deploys your DSC pool server. It's like inception of DSC.
Using DSC to deploy DSC. Got it. That's awesome.
Yeah. So, there's like a module called the XPS desired state configuration. And you can go to GitHub and find it. And in there is a resource called XDSC web service. And you can call that resource and say, deploy this pool server on that server. I want it to run on that port. I want it to run on that SQL server. And you say, go. And then 5 minutes later, you have a pool server running.
That's pretty slick. All right. Because I remember I tried to set up a pool. I tried to set up a pull server manually once, and it was a little rough.
Yeah. Yeah. I think especially back in the day when it was like version like 4, then you didn't have names for your agents. Yeah. They all had IDs. And it was like, yeah, who am I talking to here? I don't know. And it got a bit better in version 5 and then 5.1. But I mean, like you said, I think Microsoft is saying, I'm pretty sure the official word is now that they're not going to develop it anymore. It's they've given it SQL Server support, which is one thing the community was begging for. It used to run on a little JetDB, but now it runs on SQL Server. But there are a ton of open source projects. I don't want to be like favorites and pick ones out, but there's one by Ben Helens. Course like DSC pull server reloaded or something, and that's a quite a nice one. I think that runs in a Docker container, really nice. But there are some other, if you just look around at GitHub, I think there's one called Tugs, and there's various different projects that people have used to create their own implementations of the pull server, and they've got like nice GUIs, and you can click around and change the configurations without having to dig into the SQL database or go to the clients directly.
That sounds pretty good. So let's move into sort of we talked about all the different ways that you could automate Azure Automation, DSC, et cetera. Let's talk a little bit about the reality of running some of these automations and some issues that might crop up. So starting out, we talked about Runbox starting out. So what are some gotchas when it comes to Runbox, some things to look out for?
Yeah, so are you talking Azure Automation?
Yeah, in Azure Automation, yeah.
Yeah, so there are some commands which you will break Azure Automation if you try and run them.
okay, that's a problem.
Yeah, so I can't even narrow it down. I don't think there's actual like a pattern, because sometimes it will throw it and sometimes it won't. But for example, if you try to do a get member on an object, sometimes it will just kill automation. Your runbook will say, sorry, I've tried to run 3 times and I wasn't successful, so therefore I'm dead. And you go, wow. Oh, okay, I'm not allowed to run that command. So there are some commands which I think are blocked for the safety of the platform. They don't want to You don't want people being able to run whatever they want and completely annihilating Azure. But yeah, there are some weird gotchas with some commands in there. So I think that's like a trial and error type situation. You have to be burnt a few times to work out which commands are allowed and which ones aren't.
Huh. Yeah. So there's not an official list from Microsoft that you are allowed to run and not run.
I don't believe there is an official list. No, it's like a little adventure that we go on together every time we run an automation runbook. But, okay. But yeah, I mean, just in general, when you talk about creating your runbooks, you always want to keep them standardized. Like I said, do you want to basically they're like functions. So but you don't declare a function that you can create a little param block at the top. It's like when people create scripts, like if you ever developed a very formal script and you've got you can create your little param block up the top there and then you can write all your script inside. But there's one other gotcha, which I'll let you in on, is that it does not support the begin, process, and end blocks.
I don't.
I don't think that's. I don't think that's as well documented anywhere. That's one thing that burned me once. Is I don't know if people are aware of what the begin, process, and end blocks are, but it basically one thing it allows you to do is you can support the pipeline. So I feel like I'm getting really developer for PowerShell people. I feel there's like some infrastructure people who are just like, what is this guy going on about? He's talking about really crazy PowerShell stuff. But I'm going to talk to like the niche three people here that are listening about PowerShell commands. But yeah, so the process block enables you to support the pipeline. And you can basically just order how things are run. It's like a nice little grouping. So you can say whatever runs in the begin block will run once and it will run at the beginning. You have the end block will only run once and it runs at the end. And your process block runs every time for every object that you pass into it. So if you do something like a get child item pipe remove item, then every item that you've passed into it will run through this process block. So that's not supported in Azure Automation. If you use that syntax, it will just not run your, it won't error, because that would be helpful and then you would know you've done something right. Wrong. It just won't run your process block. So it will run the beginning and end blocks and your process block just won't execute.
Okay, that is good to know. I've used that a little bit when I was writing some more advanced function stuff. So that's definitely one of the deeper dives for PowerShell folks, but it's good to know if you're into using that sort of thing, and especially if you're trying to create that sort of modular framework you've been talking about, where you've got all these smaller runbooks that really would like to use that pipeline. It's sad that that's missing.
Like I say, you sort of hit the nail on the head there. I think it's one of those things that's just very niche. I don't think many people are going to use it, but if you're trying to get on this, I want to be standardized. I want to write my code right. You're sitting there, you're all hyped up, lots of energy. You go, okay, I'm going to read this best practices guideline, and they say, okay, write in begin, process, end. You do it, you put it in Azure Automation, and it doesn't work. And it can be a little bit demotivating at the beginning when you hit these sort of pitfalls. But you've got to persevere, and you've got to keep going.
Right, right. And the worst part is it doesn't tell you why it's not working. It just doesn't work. Those are always fun to debug. It's like, just start stripping things out. Speaking of trying to figure out why things work, what about testing runbooks outside of those couple of things? Are there any like testing best practices or things you've discovered about testing runbooks that'll make people's lives easier if they are using Azure Automation?
Yeah, so I'm really sort of speaking to the PowerShell people here, but there's a framework, open source framework called Pesta.
Okay.
I don't know if you're familiar with it.
I am.
And that's basically the framework that everybody, I'm pretty sure it's the unanimous framework for testing in PowerShell. So I think it was originally designed for unit testing. And sort of just to briefly describe what unit testing is when you take one of these, you know, atomic units that we talked about at the beginning of the podcast, these functions that do a particular thing like get, and it will test that one particular thing and make sure that it does exactly what it's supposed to do. So that's what a unit test is. But I've also seen people actually use Pesta for infrastructure testing. So because all it does is it will return a true or false and then will give you a green line or a red line in your console. So people have used it for doing things like, oh, I'm going to check all my best practices of a SQL server. Okay. I know the guys over at DBA Tools, they use that a lot. So I'm going to check that all my memory restrictions are in place, that all my max parallelism is set correctly, and bang, 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 bang. And then you get a nice report at the end that says, okay, you know, 45 from 50 of your best practices are set correctly, and the remainder are left hanging for whatever reason. So yeah, Pester is the framework you use for testing.
Okay. I mean, that I've done a little bit with Pester when I was doing some PowerShell development work, because now Microsoft, if you want to put anything in their repositories, you have to write Pester tests for anything you're going to submit to PowerShell. Otherwise, they'll be like, nope, go write a Pester test. So.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, this is where we want to get to. This is what we're going to try and encourage all the listeners to do, is when they go and do their next project, they want to be testing it, because, you know, it's not just trying to annoy people. I know there's plenty of people that go, oh my gosh, I have to write a test. Why do I have to do that? I only wrote like 2 lines of code. Why do I need to test that? But, you know, it doesn't matter if it's 2 lines or if it's 100 lines, you know, you will inevitably forget what you did or why you did it, or you'll forget that it's there, and someone will change something on the in front of it or behind it or in the middle of it, and then it just breaks and you go, what, why, how, where? And your unit testing will be able to, if you wrote them correctly, will be able to isolate whereabouts your problem has occurred, and then you can go in and just say, idiot, I changed that value from a 1 to a 5, that quickly just changed that back, and then and off you go. So it seems like a lot of effort at the time when you first get in there. You think, oh, now it takes me like 5 hours to write this function instead of 30 minutes. But over time, you get quicker and quicker and quicker, and inevitably, it will save you time in the long run.
Yeah, when it comes to testing, I didn't fully appreciate how important testing was until, you know, a few years into scripting and realizing, like, it's great when things work, but it's more important to know why they're actually working properly, because eventually they're going to break and you need to know why it broke. And if you don't know why it worked in the first place, you're going to discover debugging it is really, really difficult. So that's come back to bite me many times. Mm-hmm. So it's more work up front, but
really,
you know, if you're going to try to maintain that script over any period of time, you're going to forget why you did things. And so good comments and good testing are going to make you a very happy person.
Yeah, very, very much so. And I think it's not just about helping ourselves. I mean, obviously it does help ourselves, but it can also encourage people to work on your project as well. I think sometimes it can seem a bit daunting when you know, if you ever walked into GitHub and tried to work on PowerShell core project, you could walk in there as like a million lines of code in there, and you'd think, okay, I'm going to change this one line, but you wouldn't trust yourself to change it, because you go, well, if I broke something, no one's ever going to know until like 6 months later when someone tries to do something and it's like, why is that broken? And then you look in the commit history and you see, oh, you know, Ned changed this thing and now it's all broken. It's all your fault, Ned. If you have testing in there, it can catch these things, but it promotes trust. I know I'm not going to break anything because I'll see immediately that this thing has triggered a failure in the code. So
that's probably, I feel like we've covered PowerShell pretty well. But in terms of DSC, since you're using that in the cloud and on-prem as well, what are some gotchas, some things to look for and that type of thing when it comes to using DSC?
I think I don't want to put people off DSC. I think it's a super amazing tool.
Okay.
Maybe just to try and like boost it up a little bit before I knock it down a few pegs. It's a super cool way of managing your environment. So, basically the whole premise is that there are three actions that occur in your when you run DSC. So it will first get the current state. So let's say you want to deploy a website. Mm-hmm. It will try and get the website. So I say get website Contoso Bank app. You know, that's the typical Microsoft example. And then after it's run that get, it will run a test. And the test will try and validate all of the properties that are assigned. So you might, for example, say, okay, the app should be there or the app shouldn't be there. So it will test, okay, is it present or not present? But then it can go deeper as well. It can test, okay, well, is the path for the website set correctly? Is the port set correctly, et cetera? And then once the test fails or passes, it will know whether to run the set afterwards. And the set is the last component. And that's the component that we are all familiar with today. Normally when we write code, we don't bother testing if something is already there. We just assume that we're writing something for a brand new environment and then we just deploy it. So your set just runs and it will go and create your website or delete your website regarding depending on whether you passed it the present or not present. So that's DSC in a nutshell. You can define something nicely in code, you know, these keywords that we throw around nowadays, infrastructure as code, and then 5 minutes later you've got a running application. So that's the amazing bit of DSC. When you explain that to somebody, they think, wow, it's amazing, how do I install this? Now the bad point of DSC is that I think for people to get on board, I think it's very complicated. There's not a lot of examples on how to connect all of the individual parts together. So most people are going to say, okay, how do I set up my web app? And you think, oh well, okay, well you can go to the website DSC resource, and you go, well, okay, listen, I've not just got a website, I've got a database as well, and I've not just got a database, I've got users that I need to create, and it's not just this and it's that, and there's a ton of other things, and you firstly need to know that these resources even exist, and then second you need to know how to get them to link all together. So I think that's one of the first obstacles for people is actually knowing where to even start with writing a DSC configuration. And I think one of the other big problems that people come across when they start looking at DSC is you are very configuration driven, or configuration data driven, better said, sorry. So you need to have somewhere where you store all of this data. Normally when you run something, you'll just maybe pass in one thing, or worst case scenario, people are hard coding things in their script. And you know, some people as well, they react to things. So as I'm going through my thing, I'm creating a VM, and then I create a certificate, and then I want to import that certificate, and I know what's happening because it's in my current context. I create the VM, then I create the script, the certificate, and then I import the certificate. But in DSC world, I need to know everything in advance. I need to have a very clean store where I know what my server's called, I know what the IP address is, I know what the certificate is, I know all of these, I need to know all these pieces of information. And then I pass it to my DSC config, and then it generates the configuration file, which is used to deploy the config. So I think that's the real big, you know, hurdle that people need to get over at the beginning. But for me, I think it's so rewarding when you get there. It's like,
right,
wow, I've done that, and now I know for certain that thing is good. I never have to touch that thing again. Someone can come in and try and break it. You can try all you like, but 5 minutes later, it's going to fix itself, and it's all good.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's really important to harp on is that whole get, test, and then set mentality. A lot of the times, you know, you might be deploying in a greenfield kind of situation, so you can assume nothing's there yet. So I'm building a website, and you know, I assume that IIS is not installed, and the web folder isn't loaded yet, and the website doesn't exist. So I can just create all these, what would be set commands, so set up IIS. But the great thing about DSC, or really anything that does this sort of like configuration-driven declarative format, is it's going to go check. So it continues to work after the greenfield. After day one, it continues to work day two and beyond, to keep your configuration correct. Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, it has to understand, how do I test before I run anything?
Yeah, 100%, yeah. And I think one of the I mean, not to put DSC down, I like I say, I'm a big supporter of DSC. I've contributed to some of the modules, and I've done a couple of presentations about it at conferences. But one technology that I know that does it just okay, a little bit better than DSC is Terraform. And I mean, I know we're going to talk about non-Microsoft technology, but Terraform, one of the pitfalls I think of DSC when I talk to especially like security people or people who are sort of in their old like change management mode, they want to know exactly what you're going to do to that machine. And you say, well, I'm sorry, I don't know what's going to happen because is seizing control of it. I've told it what it's supposed to do, and I trust that it knows what it's doing. And at any point in time, it can just decide to reboot the machine or to, you know, remove a disk, add a disk or whatever. Whereas with Terraform, it keeps a state of each machine, and it will go in it, or not machine, but whatever your configuration is. And before you execute the next run, a Terraform is intelligent enough to tell you, I'm actually going to go and change this, and this. So you know beforehand exactly what's going to happen. And I think that's one of the super cool things that DSC is lacking. DSC can't tell you in advance
right.
What it's going to do.
It's interesting debate there between like where you store state and how often you update it, and then being able to extract information out of that. Because DSC kind of has a state engine, but it's running locally on each machine. Whereas Terraform tries to take the state of everything and then hold it in a single state file, which may give you a more accurate view at a holistic level and lets it create that plan. But then you have DSC, which is probably going to be more accurate down to the individual machines, since it's pulling the actual configuration on a regular basis. So I don't know. I don't know which approach is better. They're just different, and I guess there's trade-offs for both. But maybe you use them together, and you know, use DSC where it makes sense for that, and Terraform where it makes sense to manage state in a different way. Is that have you been using both sort of in concert?
I'd say I'd use both together. I mean, obviously DSC can do anything. Anything can do anything. They're like. DSC could manage your Azure resources if you wanted to. I think even Michael Green, the product like manager of DSC, would look at you strange if you said, "I'm managing my Azure resources with DSC." But it's nothing more than obviously just a couple of like web calls you could build into DSC. But I think Terraform has its own sort of things that it does. It manages cloud resources, and it does that well. And I think DSC, I consider it more of like an inbox. Configuration tool. So I use them in conjunction with each other. I use Terraform to build the outside, the shell, as it were. And then I use DSC to configure the inside parts, all the actual configuration of the application. And if it's like Windows, I deploy all of my Windows infrastructure with DSC. And that's how I separate it. But I mean, just one thing. Cause I didn't want to like down on DSC. I mean, I'm a big fan of it. And you made a good point about the differences between centralized state versus local state. So there's one tool that I created because, as I mentioned, I think that it becomes an issue when you talk to people like these change managers. So you've got like your change window and you say, okay, I've created my RFC and I'm going to go and do this thing. These people want to know exactly what you're going to do for auditing reasons so you can maintain your ISO, blah, blah, blah. And what I created was a tool called Moth Compare. I don't think I've open sourced it. Okay. I might have to see if I can twist someone's arm to see if I can open source it. But what it did was I could take the previous version of a Moth file, compare it to the new version of the Moth file, and it would tell me what has changed between those two points in time. So that was useful because if you think when you're looking at DSC, you've got your configuration script, which basically said, okay, I want to create this resource, but then it's linked to a ton of configuration data. So it's not easy to see by just looking at the changes in your Git repo, what actually is going to happen. Perhaps I've changed something in my configuration data, which means that something's suddenly just going to turn on or off in my environment. So I created this Moth Compare tool, and so I can compare two Moth files, and it will tell you what the difference is between those two. So it might say, okay, you've suddenly added a SQL database to that configuration. That SQL database is going to suddenly be deployed, or it might say, I've identified that resource is exactly the same, but you've changed that property from X to Y. So that was a super interesting project when I did it. That's something that you could use. That sort of coming back to this sort of centralized state.
Okay, Yeah, and for if listeners aren't familiar with MAW files, that's the file that's produced when you run the DSC configuration, and then it uses that actual MAW file to apply the configuration to the individual machine, right?
Yeah, so I skipped over that. Yeah, so it's the intermittent part. So you write all your DSC in PowerShell, and then it spits out some file, and that's the MAW file, and then the DSC client, it's called the local configuration manager, will read that file and apply the configuration.
Excellent. All right. Well, I think we're running up against time, but if you could sort of summarize a few key points for listeners based on our conversation, what would be some main takeaways that they should have from this episode?
Well, I think you really want to be trying to push yourself into this standardized world of automation. If you're not in automation right now, get on board. you need to be in that world right now. If you're at the level where, okay, you're using automation, but you're just writing sort of scripts right now, then you need to go to the next level and you need to be writing functions. And if you're sort of at that level where you're already writing functions, then you want to be thinking about making sure you're testing your code using Pesta, using some form of platform, whether it's Azure Automation or AWS's Lambda, to trigger these processes from a centralized place, and using the event methodology to trigger these types of environments. I think that would be the main thing you want to do. And if you want to sort of like put some sugar like on top, you want to like make this like a really nice looking cake. You want to be pushing the CI/CD pipeline. I think we really got really deep into like developer topics of PowerShell and DSC. We didn't really talk too much about deployment, but the CI/CD pipeline in Azure DevOps is basically every time you make changes, it's going to automatically make its way into your environment first through your test environment and then into your production environment. So that's the way you also want to be heading. You want to be using continuous integration, continuous deployment pipeline to deploy all of your code into your cloud.
All right. Well, that's a delicious sounding automation cake that you made for us there. That's perfect. We got all the good layers in there. If people want to know more about you, where can they follow you? Where should they look for you?
Yes, I'm on Twitter under rd_Bartram.
Okay.
And I have a blog, which I'm not particularly active on. I keep saying I want to get back into it, but I've been super busy lately. Yeah. I'm going to try and get into it this year. And that's Don't Forget to Automate It. So DFTAI.ch. So if you just Google Don't Forget to Automate It, you'll find me. And that is my mantra. I tell that to everybody anywhere. I even got like a t-shirt printed off, like, don't forget to automate
that's
it.
Great.
And I'll keep saying it until someone says it back to me. I'll just be, don't forget to automate it. That's the one takeaway from today.
Okay, don't forget to automate it. That's great. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, Ryan, thank you so much for being a guest on Day 2 Cloud. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me. I look forward to maybe coming back again.
Absolutely. Thanks to Ryan for appearing on Day 2 Cloud, and thanks to you, dear listener, for tuning in. If you like the show, please subscribe and let me know on Twitter. If you have suggestions for future shows, I'd love to hear them. Until then, just remember, cloud is what happens while IT is making other plans.